Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Haldet. Coming up, Gabe Bullard interviews Congressman John Yarmuth of Louisville about challenges facing the 111th Congress. First, Kentucky's legislative session gets underway this week, with a close race for House Speaker kicking off the so-called short session. Legislators will then be faced with some hard decisions regarding the state's budget deficit. To find out more about what to expect and how it might play out, Stephanie Sanders spoke with political reporter Jack Brammer of the Lexington Herald Leader.
It looks like most of this session is going to be about fixing the state's budget. I mean, is there going to be time to do anything else?
Absolutely. The session starts next Tuesday, January 6th, with a four-day organizational session. That may seem mundane to a lot of folks, but it's very important because legislators get to pick their leaders, and leaders decide the flow of legislation, that is, what bills will be considered in the remaining days of the legislative session. So on Tuesday, lawmakers will pick their leaders, and the most exciting race is for the number one position in the State House of Representatives. And that's between the incumbent House Speaker Jody Richards, a Democrat from Bowling Green, and State Representative Greg Stumbo, a Democrat from Prestonsburg. And as you know, Stumbo was a former Attorney General. So those two men are vying to be the top leader in the House. And so I think the first part of the session, all eyes will be on that race.
And how long do we have to get things done in this particular session?
In an odd number of years, the sessions last for 30 working days. So the first 4 days are set aside for organizational purposes, to elect their leaders on Tuesday, then have committee assignments, and maybe make any changes in rules in how the House and Senate conduct their business. So they'll meet 4 days next week, Tuesday through Friday, and then after that, they will recess and won't come back until early February. And so through February and March, they'll have the last 26 days of the 30-day session. Now, that could change if they decide, along with the governor, to take some of those 26 days that are set aside for February and early March and use those days in January during the interim. The interim being after the four-day organizational session next week and the beginning of February. And they could set that time aside to work on the state budget, which is facing a $500 million shortfall.
Right. I mean, would they do that mostly just to find a solution more quickly?
They would. The governor says it would be better for the state agencies to know what they're dealing with and if they're going to have to make cuts, and they will, to go ahead and implement those cuts and see then what the economy brings to the state and if additional cuts will have to be made later. So the governor would like for it to occur in January. So right now we're not sure what that schedule is going to look like. We just know they have 30 days. Another alternative is for the governor to call a special session of the legislature during those free days in January, and then they would meet in special session and then come back in February and March and deal with the 30-day session. One advantage of having this in a special session is that any tax proposals would only need a majority vote in each chamber. That means at least 50% of the members voting for it. If they do it in the 30-day regular session, it requires a supermajority vote in each chamber, or at least 60% of the members in each chamber voting for it. But Senate President David Williams says he's not concerned about when it's held, because if there is any tax increase at all, it certainly would get more than 60% of the vote in each chamber if it were going to pass.
Sure. And we've been hearing, especially after we got some of the grim budget news about the state, we've been hearing a little bit more about a possible cigarette tax increase. Do you think that has legs?
The governor's proposing to raise the state cigarette tax from 30 cents a pack to a dollar, so there'd be a 70 cents hike. I do not expect that it would be as that much. There probably will be some increase, but most legislators, even those who favor a cigarette tax increase, saying that probably 70 cents is too much. So if they don't raise it 70 cents, as the governor wants, they're going to have to find other state programs to cut, and they're not too excited about that. So bottom line, I anticipate some increase in the cigarette tax. I would be surprised to see it go to a dollar a pack.
What other things are you going to be keeping an eye out on while the legislature's in session?
Well, the budget is the overriding issue, of course. Mentioned the cigarette tax. We've had several state agencies tell us what programs they will be cutting, possibly closing some state parks. So the budget is the number one issue. Some other issues, if they get time and to address, will deal with pension reforms. It's a very mundane topic, but it's very important for retirees in state government and local governments. So we'll be looking on pension changes, and we also will look at the problem of overcrowding in our state prisons. And again, that would take money, but there might be some changes that they can make, such as reducing sentencing for certain crimes. So we'll keep an eye on that.
Sure. And it always seems to me, and of course I'm not covering this from Frankfurt, but it seems to me that during these legislative sessions that they have to focus so hard and so intensely on one topic, and of course it's going to be the budget,
right?
That maybe they finish that a week ahead of time, but they just hadn't planned on doing so, even if they finish it before the final days of the session. And then they think, oh, well, we didn't get the ball rolling on these other topics like pension reform or like overcrowding in jail. So now we can't get to them because there's just a week left or something like that.
Well, exactly. And that's why some legislators are calling for changes in the two chambers, that more work be done during the interim. We now have annual sessions of the legislature in odd-numbered years. They meet 30 days, and even-numbered years they meet for 60 days. And they're saying that like from May through the end of December of each year, more work should and could be done in the interim, and maybe put complicated issues like pension reform and prison overcrowding on a fast track when the legislature does meet. But there are always issues, and there's always a tendency to put things off in the legislature. And I think now they're just trying to find money to do the things they want to do and try to avoid cutting some essential services to Kentuckians.
You had mentioned at the beginning of the interview the race for House Speaker.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, I mean, certainly to these two people, it's, it's a big deal, but do you think the consequence of the outcome of that race will have any major bearing on how this plays out?
Yeah, I think so, because Stumbo, in running for Speaker, is advocating a bill that would allow slot machines at Kentucky racetracks. I think if he is elected Speaker, he will be pushing that, and he maintains that this can be done without changing the state constitution. He says there's already gambling at racetracks, so why not allow slot machines? It wouldn't create casinos throughout the state, as Governor Beshear earlier proposed, but he maintains that this could raise $400-500 million a year for the state. So I think if Stumbo is elected Speaker, you'll see a stronger push in the House for slots at the track legislation. But again, it would have to go through the Senate, and the Senate has been reluctant to take up expansion of gambling issues.
Doesn't it seem, though, like just another distraction on top of, all the things we've already been talking
well,
about?
Well, that's the nature of the legislature. It seems like there are so many distractions. You've got 100 House members. You've got 38 state senators. Each of them has an agenda, and then they have to come together and just for the common good of the state. And so it is confusing, and when a session begins, you always wonder, how is this going to turn out? What is going to pass, and what's going to left lingering? There's an expression here in Frankfurt among the reporters that after all is said and done, more is said than done. And usually you can point maybe to 3 to 5 major pieces of legislation that get through each session. But that's just the legislative process.
All right, Jack Brammer, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
You'll find links to more information on the Kentucky General Assembly at our website, WFPL.org. The 111th Congress will convene for the first time Tuesday. Among them will be Kentucky's 3rd District Representative John Yarmuth of Louisville, who's beginning his second term. Yarmuth talked to Gabe Bullard about his plans for legislation, the inauguration, and working with a new president.
What are your plans for your next term?
Well, the next term obviously is going to be pretty much dominated by efforts to rebuild the economy and to improve life for the middle class in this country, because one of the things that we've clearly seen over the last few years is that the buying power of the middle class has been decimated over the last 10 years, and we have to restore our middle class or none of the rest of the economy can succeed. So that's going to involve a lot of work, and it's going to involve more than the stimulus package. I think one of the things that I certainly want to concentrate on, and I think the Obama administration does as well, is reforming our health care delivery system, because even though some people say, well, we can't afford to do universal health care in an economic decline as we are in, but I think Obama has the right attitude, and that is we can't afford not to do it, because it is an essential component of making life better for every American and in solving our economic issues. So pretty much I think that most of the focus of this term, again, is going to be on rebuilding the economy and also in establishing a sensible but comprehensive regulatory scheme so that many of the problems that led to this current crisis aren't repeated. That's going to be a very important part of our efforts over the next 2 years.
What kind of regulatory acts would you like to see put into place?
Well, I think we're going to have to, first of all, have a much more vigilant oversight of our financial institutions and our investment community. One of the things that became very clear through my work on the Oversight Committee over the last few months is that we took the attitude that the marketplace will solve everything and will correct every imbalance, and we found that that is absolutely not the truth. We have to make sure that investment instruments are made understandable, not just to the people who invest in them, but also to the institutions that issue them. Because what we found out this time was that even the some of the investment banking houses were putting out investment instruments that nobody understood. Internally, they didn't understand them. We have to have serious consideration of margin requirements. That is the amount of money that has to be put up in order to make an investment. We saw this as part of the problem, both in the initial housing market when people were enabled to buy houses with putting nothing down. They had no investment in the houses at all. And as a matter of fact, in some cases, lenders were lending more than 100% of the value of the house. So the owners didn't have any stake in the house, which made it very easy for them to walk away from it if they got in trouble. At the other end, we had investment banking houses and others issuing or essentially leveraging their assets by 30 and 40 times. So if you are basically betting 30 and 40 times what you have to lose, you don't have to go wrong on many of those, a very high percentage, before you're in default. And that's what happened when housing values came down and these instruments these bonds and so forth and credit default swaps and so forth were so highly leveraged. So you know, back in the Depression when the stock market crashed in the 20s, part of the problem was back then that investors were only required to put up 10% of the purchase price. So there you had a 10-to-1 leverage, and here we were talking about 30 and 40-to-1. So there needs to be an evaluation of margin requirements and how much leverage we're allowing. And then we also, I mean, the regulation also involves things as important, but as ordinary as occupational safety and health. Many of our oversight and regulatory bodies, Mining, Health and Safety Administration, are severely underfunded, Securities and Exchange Commission. So it's sometimes not just the rules that we have to worry about. It's also the resources that are made available to these institutions that are supposed to be protecting the consumer.
You'd mentioned healthcare, mm-hmm. access to healthcare. Are you favoring more of a plan like European countries and Canada have, where it's generally paid for and accessible, or are you favoring more of a plan where it's available but it has to be purchased?
Well, my preference is that we would move toward a system in which everyone has a basic level of coverage that that is provided through their tax revenues. So it's essentially something that would resemble everybody being involved in a Medicare type of program. I don't think the administration is in favor of that, at least that their express position isn't. They want to make sure that everybody has insurance purchased through private insurance companies, and if they can't afford it, then the government will subsidize it. That's not my preference, but if that's what that's the option that's on the table, I'd certainly prefer that to nothing. We have to do two very simple things. We have to make sure that no one in this country either dies or suffers financial ruin because of an accident or injury. Obviously, that doesn't mean we can protect everybody from dying, but we because they didn't have insurance. We have to make that's a fundamental standard that I think has to be imposed. And secondly, we have to do everything we can to reduce costs in the medical system, because right now we are paying twice as much per American citizen for health care as almost any other industrialized nation in the world. And we're not getting as good an outcome as we could. Now, at the high end, we have the best health care available in the world. There's no question about it. But not everybody has access to that. And many people, again, have access to no care. So I'm not as concerned about the structure initially as I am about the fact that we, again, accomplish those two main goals. Make sure everybody has basic health care coverage, which protects them against financial ruin or for dying when they didn't need to. And secondly, that we deal with costs and it's accessible to everybody. So I have a lot more confidence that I know what the health care system is going to look like 30 years from now than I do what it's going to look like 4 years from now or 5 years from now. But if we can work toward making sure that everybody has a certain basic level of coverage, I'm less concerned about the structure. In direct answer, or kind of an anecdote, additional comment about the European system or Canada, there are many, many forms of universal health care, quote unquote, in the world right now. Again, we're the only industrialized nation in the world that doesn't have universal care. So it's not useful to talk about Canada or France or Cuba or England, because none of those systems is exactly what we would adopt. In many of those countries, there is basically a two-tiered system. You get a very fundamental level of coverage through your tax dollars. If you want to add to that, just like Medicare recipients in this country do with supplemental coverage, you can do that as well. So there's a public and a private system in work in places like Germany. So basically what I think we need to do in this country is to say, here's what we can afford to do. How do we make this the most coverage available to everyone, again, to protect them against catastrophe, whether it's, again, physical catastrophe or life-threatening or financial one. those are our, I think, what should be our main criteria.
Do you see this first step towards improving access to healthcare as, or do you see it as a first step towards what you'd ultimately like to see healthcare become in the United States?
Well, again, my primary interest is making sure that everybody has care right off the bat. And, you know, I think when you're looking at situations like the automobile manufacturers, solving their problem has to include solving the healthcare problem, because most of the American manufacturers' cost disparity versus import manufacturers is that we have a high legacy cost involving healthcare. So I'm not as concerned about that, but again, my guess is, and I've had these conversations with the executives at Humana and many other places, the real issue is going to be that as we move forward, if in the initial stages and a generation from now, everyone who's involved in delivering health care is going to have to prove they add value to the system. And that's true of insurance companies, that's true of hospitals, that's true of doctors, and it's true of drug companies. If you're not adding value, then you're not going to be able to have a role in that system. And I'm certainly flexible enough to, within those guidelines, to support any program that I think accomplishes those main criteria. One other thing that I think, though, is something that makes more of a universal Medicare system inevitable is I don't know how you maintain an employer-based system in this country, and that both the Obama plan and some of the others that have been talked about retain the employer-based system. If you graduate from college this year, statistically, you are going to have 8 to 10 different employers by the time you're 40 years old. I don't know how, with that kind of mobility in this country, you maintain an employer-based health insurance system. And everybody, I don't think there's any citizen who hasn't heard of a horror story involving somebody moving from job to job or taking a job because of health care coverage or making a decision about whether they get married or not because of health care coverage. In this country, people should not have to make those fundamental life decisions based on whether they get health insurance coverage at a certain employer. And that's why I think ultimately that's not sustainable. Now, there are those, and I think this is where Barack's coming from, who say, we have this system in place. It insures a very large percentage of the population right now. So it's an existing mechanism. Let's not try to rebuild the whole system in one fell swoop. I understand that thinking, and it may make some sense. But again, ultimately, I don't think that kind of approach is sustainable.
You'd also mentioned a stimulus package as being one of the keys to rejuvenating the middle class. What kind of stimulus? Do you see it as mostly the infrastructure stimulus that's been talked about, or how do you see it going?
Well, we have two issues there. One is an immediate stimulus package, and that is to put people back to work to get money flowing and credit flowing through the economy so that we don't slip further into a more serious recession or even a depression. That's the type of program that we're going to be dealing with over the next few weeks, actually, that involves money to the states to help them self-subsidize spending on Medicaid and other human services, and a tax cut for middle-class Americans, and then also, I guess most importantly, an economic recovery plan to invest in infrastructure and other projects that can immediately put people back to work, create jobs, and again get money flowing. That's the first step, and again that's kind of what we could call operating in crisis mode. But on a longer perspective, stimulus also includes creating a different kind of tax structure that incentivizes work more than investment, perhaps. Looking at tax incentives to invest in green technologies and other in job creation that will create jobs that can't be outsourced, that stay in this country, in education, in job training. Those are longer-term perspectives, but are very much still part of the entire stimulus package. It's just that the outlook's a little bit different. So the initial stimulus package, which we're estimating is going to be somewhere between $750 billion and $1 trillion over the next 2 years, we're going to be working on that immediately, but also on these longer-term stimuli that are just as important, because they're going to create the future that's going to allow us, essentially, to borrow this money for the initial stimulus package. I mean, we're basically borrowing against the destiny of the country, and we have to make sure that the destiny of the country is solid, too, and that requires a longer approach. And that is not my quote. That's Alexander Hamilton from about 300 years ago.
That was Gabe Buller talking with Congressman John Yarmuth of Louisville. Learn more about the inauguration and the 111th Congress at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer reports on changes in services in the Catholic Church. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Haldet. Coming up, Robin Fisher talks with the author of The Devil Wears Prada. First, the Catholic Church saw great changes after the Second Ecumenical Council of the Vatican, or Vatican II, in the 1960s. They ushered in more involvement from lay people, and services no longer said in Latin, but in local languages. Now Catholic leaders are prescribing new rules that have some Catholics questioning the future of the Church. Elizabeth Kramer reports.
Setting rules in the Catholic Church is as old as its 2,000-year-old history. But policies leaders are making today are pointing to the past, says John Allen, a senior writer with the National Catholic Reporter.
The most important megatrend at the policy-setting level of the Catholic Church these days, both in the United States and also in Rome, is the desire to restore a strong sense of Catholic identity, that is, a strong sense of what makes Catholics different than the rest of the world. And therefore a return to a more traditional form of speech and gestures and so on in the liturgy.
And it's happening here. Last April, Louisville's Archbishop, Joseph Kurtz, sent a 7-page letter to parishes in the Archdiocese instructing them to make changes in church services. The letter detailed when parishioners should kneel and stand and directed that containers for wine and water be gilded or made of precious metal. The move was in line with the Vatican's decision in 2000 to standardize the Catholic Mass worldwide. Kurtz says it emphasized attributes of the Mass from bygone years that some Catholics missed.
Often I hear people say there's not the sense of mystery and the sense of the sacred that I felt when I was a child.
Jay Dolan is a history professor from Notre Dame University who has written extensively about the Catholic Church. He says the church has become increasingly conservative.
I think it really has a lot to do with the Pope, John Paul II. He put in a lot of people in the hierarchy who were a lot like him and had to take a loyalty oath about birth control and homosexuality and celibacy and so on and so forth. It could never be ordained a bishop.
Catholic leaders say the changes to the Mass help congregations focus on piety. But these directives pose dilemmas for some congregations that grew after Vatican II. They now have to order expensive kneelers and even rethink how they worship. For some of the faithful, the directives signal an unwelcome return to the past. That includes Jim Butler of St. William's. Now 79, Butler joined the parish 40 years ago.
When we first started, we had really good community, and the liturgy was all new. So we were the first Vatican II church in the archdiocese. We drew people from all over the county for the new church.
The church sits in an industrial part of West Louisville and focuses on social justice. During the 1970s, members protested the Vietnam War and nuclear arms. In the 1980s, the church sheltered and protected refugees fleeing war in Central America from immigration and law enforcement agencies. It established programs to help the poor in surrounding neighborhoods. At Sunday Mass, there is a modern and close-knit atmosphere. Nearly 300 people encircle the altar where the priest blesses wine and bread for communion. Musicians, including a drummer, perform on a platform at the back. and church members chime in with their prayers during parts of the Mass. Those customs vary widely from how Catholics worshipped more than 40 years ago. Ann Walters is one of the leaders of this parish, which she defines as post-Vatican II.
A lot of experimental stuff was done here, and the community grew, and from that point, a really strong social justice focus.
Some parishioners think that the Archbishop's directives disregard those values. They see them as a way for the hierarchy to assert its power in ways that could threaten this universal church that continues to lose practitioners in an increasingly secular world. Despite some grumblings, journalist John Allen and Archbishop Kurtz are optimistic. Kurtz says he believes all congregations are cooperating to establish these changes throughout the archdiocese over the next few years. But Notre Dame's Jay Dolan thinks it's all in vain for what he sees as an increasingly irrelevant church.
Most of us think we're Catholic and it's in our blood and we're going to remain Catholic come hell or high water. But I think that's my generation, and I don't think that's the younger people.
Especially for younger generations that have no memory of Catholicism before Vatican II. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
The last couple of weeks, we've been revisiting some of our favorite interviews of 2008. Today, we go back to an interview that originally aired in May. Single young women trying to find the perfect man and the perfect job in New York City. Does this sound familiar? But it's not what you think. Instead, it's the latest novel by Lauren Weisberger, author of The Devil Wears Prada. Robin Fisher spoke with Weisberger about love, friendship, and life in the big city, and her new novel, Chasing Harry Winston.
Now, your first novel, The Devil Wears Prada, was based on your actual experience working in a fashion magazine. Is there any biographical link in this particular novel?
There definitely is. I think it's the old adage, write what you know. And in this book, the characters are a little bit older. They're all right around 30, so it's not the first job out of school and the first apartment in the big city anymore. They're a little bit more established, at least in their careers, but their social lives and their romantic lives are pretty much a disaster.
Tell us a little bit about Lee, Emmy, and Adriana.
The three girls met in college, and they have been best friends ever since. And the book sort of opens with Emmy finding out that her boyfriend of 5 years, who she had pegged as her future husband, actually is leaving her for the trainer at the gym that she pays for, and she bought him the trainer as a birthday present. And it's sort of this nightmare that leads Emmy and the girls to sit down over dinner and make a pact that in 1 year they're going to drastically change their lives. Emmy, who has been a serial monogamist, is going to become a whole lot more promiscuous, and she pledges that she's going to start brazenly sleeping around. And Adriana, who is the gorgeous, fabulous, very glamorous Brazilian who has had no trouble with men her whole life, has decided that it's time to settle down, and she's going to find herself a husband. In 12 months, she's going to have a ring on her finger. And Lee, the third one, who is a bit more even than Emmy and Adriana, she seems to have the perfect job and the perfect boyfriend and the perfect apartment, can't really think of anything she wants to change, but of course we find out as the book goes on that her life is kind of the biggest disaster of all.
Because you kind of know from the beginning, as a reader, what she needs to change with
Lee.
Yes,
but yes,
she is such
do.
A type A person that she just can't see it.
I think that's absolutely true. And she's in one of those relationships that I think so many people can relate to, that perfect on paper. He is perfect on paper. Everyone loves him. He's not a bad guy. He's a terrific guy who's in love with her. And she just doesn't feel the same way.
Now, of the three, Adriana, I think, is the most feminine and the most masculine. So I wondered if you had her in your head first, or did she just evolve?
Oh, that's interesting. She did sort of just evolve, and I know what you mean. She's really feminine in that very girly way. She's beautiful, and she's sexy, and she wears high heels and dresses all the time, but she definitely has a no-holds-barred attitude towards men.
She
collects them like men collect women.
She does. She approaches relationships as I would think men do.
Definitely. She definitely does. And, you know, without giving away anything at the end, I wanted her to stay true to that. It just didn't seem fitting that she totally changed her personality. So I won't say what happens, but Adriana does sort of keep that charming quality.
Each of the women actually throughout the book changes, as we mentioned. Mm-hmm. But Lee and Emmy especially are just as concerned about their careers as their love lives. And I wondered, do you think this is typical of women of that age group today?
Oh, I definitely do. I think it's that constant struggle to maintain that balance in your life. You know, you have the three, at least for me and my friends, we're always talking about there's these three aspects, overall aspects of your life, your romantic life and your social life and your professional life. And you're always working really hard to change one of them and get it up to shape. And as soon as you do, the other two fall apart. So, you know, I really wanted to kind of strike that chord of reality and have these girls dealing with all the different areas of their lives, because I do think that today that's what women are thinking about.
There are some interesting exchanges in the book about fashion and beauty, but it's not as fashion-centered, of course, as The Devil Wears Prada, and you don't get the feeling that it's, these girls are not shallow, let me put it that way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's set in New York, and New York is a great backdrop for a novel. It's never sleeps, it's super exciting, there's all different kinds of people who live here, but I really wanted this book to be more about the girls' relationships with their family, with their significant others, and mostly with each other. So, you know, the clothes and the kind of parties add a little bit of color, but it's not the central focus.
There's an interesting exchange in the book between Lee and the author that she's working with, Jesse, about chick lit.
Yes, I couldn't resist.
I thought that was very interesting. Do you think that chick lit gets a bad rap?
It does sometimes. You know, people kind of like to write it off as just pure entertainment, and I'm not totally sure why that's the worst thing in the world. I think anything that gets people to pick up a book and helps them relax and makes them laugh and keeps them entertained and keeps them coming back for more is pretty great. So,
and you know, I want to stay on this for just a second, because unbeknownst to our listeners right now, Lee is a book editor, and she is editing a literary giant.
Yes.
But for pleasure, that she reads chick lit. And you mentioned some real books in there, not just books that you've made up.
Yes, absolutely. So it just seemed fitting to me, because I think that is also something that's pretty realistic. Just because she has a literary sensibility at work and is editing all sorts of historical fiction and memoir and literary fiction, in her free time she chooses to read a book that others would classify as chick lit, and she finds a lot of redeeming things in it. So I couldn't resist.
Who's your favorite character in the book?
I don't know that I could choose, but I like Lee's neuroses. It's something I can relate to a lot, relate to really, really well. But I find that endearing about her. I like that she's so neurotic and at the same time, she's kind of crazed by all the little things, but not totally seeing the big picture.
You mentioned this earlier, and I actually had this as one of my questions. At its heart, the book is a testament and a tribute to women's friendships.
Definitely.
And it was that your inspiration for the book?
Oh, definitely. It absolutely was. And their relationship is so similar to mine with some of my closest girlfriends, and I'm still astounded every single time. It gets harder and harder as we get older and our lives get busier and they're changing, but I can still go out to dinner with any one of my closest, you know, two or three girlfriends, and we'll sit and 4 hours just evaporate. They vanish into nothing. The two of us haven't stopped talking the entire time. We're listening, and it's so cathartic and it's so wonderful. And despite husbands and families and peers and colleagues, like, there's nothing like a girlfriend.
Well, my final question that I have to ask, because I guess there's somebody out there that doesn't know, who is Harry Winston?
I'm sure there are. But Harry Winston is the jeweler that adorns all of the celebrities on the red carpet at the Oscars, and they have really fabulous, really kind of aspirational for all of us boutiques, jewelry stores all over the country, and they have just the most gorgeous, gorgeous diamonds one could ever imagine.
Well, Lauren, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That was Robin Fisher talking with author Lauren Weisberger about her latest novel, Chasing Harry Winston. When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer talks with folk music legend Gene Ritchie. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL.
Oh, mother, oh, mother, come riddle it down. Come riddle two hearts as one. Say, must a merry fair ale endure, or bring the brown girl home?
Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Gene Ritchie was born in eastern Kentucky and grew up singing the traditional music of the region. In 1946, she moved to New York City and took her music with her to become a major force in the American folk music movement, alongside Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie. She also was a friend of Alan Lomax, who collected Native music from around the world and worked for the Library of Congress. Now Ritchie, age 86, has decided to leave her work to the Library of Congress. Elizabeth Kramer spoke with Ritchie about her decision and her career in folk music.
What led to your decision to donate your work to the Library of Congress, and what materials are going to be included?
I decided to put my life collection, I called it, into the Library of Congress because a friend, Alan Lomax, had donated his, and the Library of Congress had asked me to come participate in his program, and I sort of got familiar with it that way. And then it came up, I guess, after they met me and I met them. I performed there. I sang a song for Alan. Then very soon after that, I had a request from the library to come in and donate my own things. Letters, field recordings, letters from people about my coming to perform. I have a whole wonderful set of letters from the Harvard Summer School in the 1960s or something, and all the best-known folk song people were there. I remember that I just had one of the best times of my life being there because everybody was so appreciative. I was, well, almost worshipped by some people, and that was a very new thing for me. I almost didn't survive it, but I did.
And the history between Alan Lomax and your family goes back to the 1930s, is that correct?
Well, no, he didn't really visit my family then.
Okay.
But he did visit the Hindman Settlement School.
What transpired at that time?
Alan Lomax and his father came around, was it in the 1920s? I can't quite remember, a little bit, maybe the 30s. And they collected from people all around us, but they didn't meet my family at that time. But he heard about us. And so when I came to New York, I met somebody who knew Alan and wanted me to go meet him because they said, you have so many songs. He'll be glad to hear you. So I did. We made an appointment, and I went to meet Alan. He was working at Decca Records then. And when I came in, he asked me where I lived in Kentucky, and I told him, Perry County, near Hazard. And he said, well, we almost found you then, but we never found you. And so it was kind of a delayed a delayed meeting. But I sang him some ballads, and he said, I need to record everything you know. He said about doing that, he didn't record everything I knew, but he recorded all the ballads, I think, that were in our family and everything.
As I understand it, your donation is going to include field recordings.
Yes, I had a grant. My husband went with me as a photographer. I had a Fulbright scholarship. It was to England, Scotland, and Ireland. I wanted to find where our songs came from and got over there and found out that they came from all three countries. I couldn't pin it down. One thing that I did that you might be interested in is that I used a song that almost everybody in the world knows, and that was the ballad Barbara Ellen. And I used that as a collecting tool. I would go into a a little cottage in Ireland and sit down and sing Barbara Ellen, play my dulcimer and sing Barbara Ellen. And they would get very, very excited and could hardly wait until I finished to tell me that they knew it, that song also, you know, so it was a collecting tool. And then they would sing me their Barbara Ellen, and then that would remind them of other songs. And the fiddler would come in and play fiddle tunes, and one thing would lead to another. It was really a wonderful time that we had over there.
Well, considering your scholarship and also your career, what changes have you seen in folk music over the years that you think have fortified the art form?
I think there's more interest because of all the collecting, all the articles that have been written and so on. There's people know more about it, and it's a more accepted kind of music. It used to be that when I went to sing in a concert in the college, I was never asked by the music department. I was always asked by the sociology department, and folk music just wasn't recognized as music. Now it's very well accepted and loved in all places, it seems, and it seems it's had a wonderful growth over the years, which is only right because folk music is where it all came from. It's where all kinds of music came from. It's like a river you can go and dip into and fashion in the way you want. It is wonderful to have that source, and people have recognized that. It all came through to me through my family, through my own family and relatives and community. It tells where I'm from. It tells about how the music lived there and was passed around to different people, keeping the same story going. And I'm very grateful to my mother, to my father, to all the people who sang with me and taught me and rocked me and passed the music on.
Have there been any ways, since you've been living in New York for years, that you keep in touch with that? Do you visit Kentucky often?
As often as we can. We have a house down there. We build ourselves a log house out of some old houses that belonged to relatives, and so we recycle them into our log house. And we go down and spend time there, and folks come to see us, and we go to see them, and we look around for more places to hear music. Apple Shop in Whitesburg is near us, and they are always having people in to sing. And we quite often hear some singers that we've never heard before, which is, it's always good to hear another singer coming along and carrying on the traditions.
Do you still perform and write?
I perform maybe one concert a month. I mean, I would say that would be the average. It used to be I'd done 30 or 40 concerts a year. I don't do that much anymore. I am 86, mm-hmm. So I've had to slow down a little bit. I still enjoy singing, but I can't, as you can hear by my voice, it is rather scratchy now, and that's because 2 years ago I had bronchitis, and I never quite recovered from it. The voice never quite recovered from it, and I always think I can't sing, but when I get on stage, I think, well, I'll open my mouth and see what comes out, and I start singing, and it seems to clear up. I think my high register is still there, but the low register is not.
And what songs do you enjoy singing these days when you do perform?
The old ones like Camellia Fair and Tender Ladies and Barbara Ellen and the ballads, Lord Thomas and Fair Ellender. I've had to think very carefully about the ones I sing because if I sing one that's too long, I might not get through it. So I pick one that's not too long.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Did you ever see three true lovers meet that had so soon to part? Oh, mother, go dig my grave and dig it both wide and deep and bury Fair Ellender in my arms and the brown girl at my feet.
You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.